I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Ahead this evening, residents of a North Philadelphia neighborhood work to take back their community's identity. First, the U.S. Supreme Court heard from attorneys today in a Texas case that could shutter abortion clinics in that state. Some of the rules under dispute in Texas were adopted in Pennsylvania years ago. From the WHYY Health Desk, Tanya English reports.
Protesters of all stripes gathered on the steps outside the Supreme Court in Washington. Amanda Kifferly called from her cell phone to describe the scene.
We're seeing signs here that says trust women. I see signs saying politicians aren't doctors.
Kifferly is director of patient advocacy at the Philadelphia Women's Center. She says her clinic cares for women from as far away as Ohio because state rules across the country have made abortion access difficult. Attorney Sue Fritchie from the Women's Law Project says targeted state laws don't make women safer.
We know that the real effect of the Texas law and the purpose of that law is to make it harder and sometimes impossible for women to get high-quality care in a timely manner.
Pennsylvania's law, enacted after authorities shut down Kermit Gosnell's West Philadelphia clinic, demands that abortion providers meet the same standards as outpatient surgery centers. That was expensive for clinics, and a few shut down. But unlike Texas, Pennsylvania did not demand doctors obtain admitting privileges at a local hospital. Maria Gallagher is legislative director for Pennsylvania Pro-Life Federation. She says Pennsylvania simply adopted basic health precautions.
It's too soon to say how a Supreme Court ruling might affect Pennsylvania, but we remain hopeful that the Texas law will be upheld and that common sense regulations in Pennsylvania will remain in place.
The Supreme Court will likely rule on the Texas case by summer. I'm Tanya English, WHYY News.
A long-shot challenger in a suburban Philadelphia congressional race is winning support in at least one county. WHYY's Laura Benchoff has more on a conservative primary challenge to a three-term Republican congressman, Pat Meehan.
After a close vote, some Republican Party officials in Berks County decided to endorse conservative businessman Stan Cassasio over incumbent Pat Meehan in the April primary. The district includes parts of five counties. Chester County GOP Chairman Val DiGiorgio says it's unusual not just because the Berks contingent is picking an outsider.
It's very unusual for the Berks County committee to even decide to endorse. That's not their culture.
Now, Berks County Republicans are saying they might withdraw their endorsement. But campaign manager Sean Gale says the vote shows Cassasio's message is resonating with voters.
You can't go to Washington and vote to fund Planned Parenthood, vote to fund Obamacare, and then come back and say you're a Republican.
Meehan was not in office yet when the federal health law first passed and has since voted to repeal it, as well as to defund Planned Parenthood. Even if Berks County Republicans go for Cassasio, leaders like DiGiorgio say Meehan enjoys strong support in the other counties.
The organizational strength of the county committees in Montgomery, Delaware, and Chester make him the odds-on favorite.
Relatively few Republican voters in the 7th Congressional District live in Berks County. The rest are in Delaware, Montgomery, Chester, and Lancaster counties. Laura Benchoff, WHYY News.
Saying, we're past the time when we can rely on a rising tide to lift all boats, Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney is prioritizing an inclusive neighborhood approach to planning and development. Now just shy of completing his first 2 months in office, let's see how that effort is going with Anne Fadulin, new director of planning and development for the city of Philadelphia. Anne, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Sure. Pleasure to be here.
And you were part of this transition committee. What were some of the bullet points that were developed?
Yeah, so I was co-chair of the Housing Planning and Development Transition Committee. And I think some of the key things that were developed is how important it was for the city to have an overall strategic housing plan. We have done a good job of having affordable housing plans and some other types of neighborhood plans, but there's really a need now to take a look at housing as a whole and not just focus on what are we going to do with federal subsidy dollars in the way of doing affordable housing, but how are we going to do equitable development and try to provide housing choice in as many neighborhoods as possible.
What are some of the main ways that Mayor Kenney's plan diverges from that of his predecessor, Michael Nutter?
I think actually it's very informed by the Nutter administration. They had kind of created this very large umbrella connecting planning, housing, and commercial development all as one, all under Alan Greenberger, who I have to say did a fabulous job. I think those of us who saw what the city was like in 2008 when kind of the whole world fell off a cliff, and then what we're seeing, you know, now or at the end of 2015 when that administration left office, I don't think any of us would have predicted in 2008 that we'd see what we saw in 2015. And Mayor Kenney wants to build on that, and I think we want to figure out how to keep this trend going in Philadelphia. We're learning how to be a growth city as opposed to a city that was managing decline. But I think what we learned in that period is while there's a lot more cranes in the sky and there's a lot of development in Center City, that we're not necessarily seeing the economic development we'd like to see in our neighborhoods. And we're not necessarily seeing the job growth numbers we would have liked to have seen.
So as evidenced in part by the plethora of vacant land still to this day. What are plans for those properties?
Right. So the city did create a land bank. There's been a lot of kind of behind-the-scenes work done there, getting titles cleared, figuring out what we really own, and those kinds of things. Now at the end of 2015, we just started to see the first parcels of land get transferred into the land bank. I believe we're around 1,700 parcels now. So we're well on our goal to try to get, around upwards of 2,000 in there by the end of this year. And now we've got to figure out the other part of that equation, which is, land bank is a little bit of a misnomer. We don't necessarily want to bank the land there. We actually want people to withdraw it and get it back into productive use. So we're looking very closely at what we can do to jumpstart getting land out of the land bank. And then also we have a tool for acquisition that may allow us to combine into some larger parcels that may be more ripe for development.
And speak to the inherent tension in a public-private partnership where developers want to make a buck. That's their purpose. And so that would push them more toward segments of the city where that dollar can perhaps more easily be made than in other neighborhoods.
Right. The perception of what Center City was maybe 15, 20 years ago, that has really grown. Center City encompasses a much larger area now. The interesting things that have happened in Center City and people want to be close to that, but they can't afford as much proximity as they may have before. So we're seeing that spread out a little bit into some of the neighborhoods, but not into all of the neighborhoods. And while there's this dichotomy between, let's say, affordable and more market rate, I really think that sometimes that's a false pretext because we need both. And they don't necessarily need to conflict with each other. We'd like to make more investment into the city. And in order to do that, we need a tax base. And so it's great to attract that market in here, but we need to provide quality, affordable housing to all of our residents. It's not the easiest conundrum, but I think there's probably more commonality there than people realize.
Anne Fadulin, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure being here. I really appreciate it.
Anne Fadulin is the new Director of Planning and Development for the City of Philadelphia. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Taking a look at this evening's headlines, federal authorities have charged a second Philadelphia municipal court judge with making false statements to the FBI during an investigation of potential wrongdoing. Authorities allege that Judge Joseph O'Neill was approached by Judge Joseph Walters about a small claims case scheduled for a hearing before him. Walters allegedly told O'Neill the defendant was a friend and asked him to, quote, take a hard look at it. Authorities maintain that O'Neill later denied to FBI investigators that he'd been contacted about the hearing. Waters was sentenced in January to 2 years in prison after pleading guilty to federal mail and wire fraud in conversations with colleagues on behalf of a friend or campaign donor. A high-ranking New Jersey lawmaker who has not signed on to a proposed state takeover of Atlantic City's finances says such a move should not be allowed to break contracts for police, firefighters, and other municipal workers. Assembly Speaker Vincent Prieto says a takeover bill pending in the legislature needs to be changed to ensure the state cannot unilaterally cancel public employee contracts, something the bill would currently permit. Introduced by Senate President Steve Sweeney and backed by Governor Chris Christie, the measure would strip Atlantic City of most of its decision-making power, giving the state the right to break contracts, dissolve agencies, and sell off city assets, all to help get Atlantic City's troubled finances under control. 37 degrees, mostly clear skies on Independence Mall. It's 6:15. You're listening to NewsWorks tonight on WHYY. Clear and cold the call this evening, bottoming out at 26 degrees overnight. Tomorrow, clouding up Thursday's high around 40. Friday, a rain-snow mix likely, high 38 degrees. Still ahead, Pennsylvania's Cheney University is one of many public, historically black colleges struggling to stay afloat.
We're nervous about it, but at the same time, we know since it is like a national treasure, we're hoping that like we'll just be able to pull through. Because I don't want Cheney closed. I love Cheney.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Guided by Quaker values, Folkways at Gwinnett, a continuing care retirement community for active adults 65 and over since 1967, supports WHYY. Folkways provides residents with proven financial stability, a comprehensive health care program, and a community where friendship, caring, dignity, and respect are a way of life. Select apartments highlighting their newest design features are now available. To discover Folkways Retirement Community and to arrange for a personal tour, 215-283-7010. 215-283-7010.
Support for WHYY comes from the Rutgers-Camden Professional MBA and Professional Masters in Accounting programs, cohort-based accelerated degree programs designed for working professionals with classes held on Saturdays in Princeton. The next cohort begins this fall. An information session is on Tuesday, March 15th at 6 p.m. at the Crown Plaza, Princeton. pmba.rutgers.edu or 856-225-2700. The Rutgers-Camden Professional Degree Programs. Expect more. Be more.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Many historically black colleges or universities, known as HBCUs, are struggling. They struggle financially, and they struggle to attract and keep students. Public HBCUs are some of those hardest hit. In the first of two stories, WHYY's Sarah Hoover reports on how Cheney University in the Philadelphia suburbs is faring as it deals with the national trend.
Sophomore Anitra Jackson is just one of two math majors at Cheney. She plans to be a computer engineer for NASA and wanted to attend a small school. Cheney has around 700 students. That's a 30% drop from last year and half of what it was 5 years ago.
Because the ratio is so small, I can literally just go knock on my professor's door, even if it's not office hours, like, hey, can I ask you a quick question? And they'll literally do a one-on-one session.
Jackson came to Cheney because of its Keystone Honors Academy program. It offers full scholarships, including tuition and room and board, to qualifying students. The Delaware County native, who's on the university's track team, plans to finish her degree at Cheney, but could transfer. A double major in math and computer science, Jackson says getting math courses can be difficult, and she worries Cheney is in danger of closing.
I know a lot of us are nervous, like we're nervous about it, but at the same time, we know since it is like a national treasure, we're hoping that like we'll just be able to pull through. Because I don't want Cheney to close. I love Cheney. I love Cheney at the end of the day.
Cheney, the nation's oldest HBCU, is one of 14 universities that make up Pennsylvania's state system of higher education, which includes Westchester and Millersville universities. Cheney, which straddles Chester and Delaware counties, has had enrollment and financial issues for years, but it got worse last year. The university's accreditation was placed on probation. Without it, students would no longer be eligible for state or federal financial aid. Cheney's relied on its third line of credit from the state system and is waiting to see if it will have to repay up to $30 million in federal aid funds it mismanaged.
The publics are under some interesting pressures.
That's Mary Beth Gasman, director of University of Pennsylvania's Center for Minority-Serving Institutions. She says HBCUs generally have to do more with less. HBCUs represent only 2% of all colleges and universities in the country and enroll 8% of African American college students. But their graduates make up 21% of African Americans getting diplomas.
What that shows us is that they are doing a better job with low-income black students. And I think that that's really important, right? Because they're doing it with fewer resources.
Public black colleges tend to enroll low-income and underprepared students who can take longer to finish. Cheney's interim president, Frank Pogue, says in spite of limited resources, the school has a reputation for transforming underprepared students.
We have far too many of the students coming through K through 12 poorly prepared for all the reasons we know about. So we have to work harder than most institutions to make sure that our students are successful. But it's always been that way.
Cheney's six-year graduation rate is 26%. The national average is 43%. Gasman says the majority of HBCU students are on Pell Grants, including 75% of Cheney students, a far different student makeup than the rest of the state's public institutions.
So you can't hold a public black college to the same expectations as you can the state's flagship institution or an institution that enrolls students who are better prepared and from higher income homes.
One argument for why struggling public HBCUs are in trouble is the history of receiving unequal funding. Pogue, Cheney's president, says there's a history of neglect and underfunding that needs to be acknowledged.
We have never been equally supported. And so this feeling that one size fits all, that all 14 universities in the state system of higher education have somehow at some point in their histories have been the same, it's not true, and it's not true today. The institutions are very different, and their needs are very different.
A coalition of alumni and supporters of Cheney have filed a federal lawsuit against the state alleging racial discrimination and unfair funding. Pennsylvania higher ed officials say Cheney receives the most per student funding, four times the system's average. Gasman, the HBCU expert, says equal funding now isn't always enough.
So if you have a history of not being funded equitably, even if you're at some point being funded equally, you're not funded equitably because your wealth has not been building the same way as, let's say, a flagship institution or maybe some of the majority institutions.
Cheney's financial troubles are compounded because it has no reserves or an endowment and is operating with an estimated $16 million deficit. Gasman says HBCUs should be given credit for the critical role they provide.
They're doing the lion's share of work with regard to moving African Americans, especially into graduate school, into STEM majors, into teaching. There's a whole bunch of areas that if we didn't have HBCUs, we'd really have a substantial problem on our hands as a nation.
Losing HBCUs isn't just an issue for alumni or current students. A recent Gallup study reveals black graduates of HBCUs are more likely to succeed financially than other blacks with college degrees. And these grads also feel far more confident they are prepared for life after college. For WHYY News, I'm Sarah Hoover.
Philadelphia is known as a city of neighborhoods, most of which have well-defined borders and names like Germantown, Old City, Mayfair. But that's not the case for a slice of North Philadelphia near the Schuylkill River. As WHYY's Aaron Mozell reports, two neighbors are trying to change that by reclaiming a piece of largely forgotten history in this report for WHYY's Every Zip Philadelphia project.
Instead of planting from the ground, we would like to raise the beds and add sandstone and gravel and maybe some pavers in between the islands between the raised beds.
Inside his living room, Lamont DeShields is laying out his plans for a community garden he wants to grow in his corner of North Philadelphia near 27th and Allegheny Avenue. He thinks it could be a bright spot in an area that sits inside one of the city's busiest police districts. Fellow community activist Vincent Kennedy does too.
This here is the first start of really trying to get our neighborhood back. And it starts in one area, then it reaches out to the next, and then the next, and then the next. This is just a building stone.
Kennedy knows it'll take more than a community garden. So along with others, he's using a bit of grassroots rebranding. Over the years, the area has become known simply as North Philly. But Kennedy and some neighbors say it's a distinct part of the city. That's why they're reviving one of the city's most mysterious neighborhood names. Swamp Poodle.
It done fell off the map. They done considered everything as Strawberry Mansion, which is not. This is Swamp Poodle. This is not Strawberry Mansion. So why not give Swamp Poodle what it needs? Give us the help we need. Give us the righteousness that we need and respect our name.
He's not the only one who wants that.
I'd like, you know, some kids to have an opportunity to know what it really is to live in a neighborhood where people know people and people respect people.
Denise Whitaker is standing beneath a flapping green and white banner near 28th and Allegheny Avenue, less than a mile from Vincent Kennedy's place. She's vice president of the Community Action Group.
We've lost it and we want to bring it back because it's a good thing. You know, it's a good feeling.
As part of that effort, Whitaker's group used some grant money to purchase about a dozen banners like the one above her. They all feature a green silhouette of a poodle and the name of perhaps the city's newest neighborhood, Swamp Poodle Heights.
When you say Swamp Poodle to people, they go, what? And it wasn't like a name that sounded very attractive. You know, paradise sounds wonderful, Strawberry Mansion, you know. We wanted to put something with that would mentally give a connotation of something nice, not a, you know, a swamp or puddles of water, you know.
The banners went up about a year ago and still make Whitaker smile, but it could take others longer to come around on Swamp Poodle, Heights or otherwise, including community garden activist Lamont DeShields.
Now, if he had told me, said, man, you know, you from Swamp Poodle, I said, where the is that? In fact, what is Swamp Poodle? In my mind, it's a swamp that may be coming to a puddle, which people don't live in.
Planted beneath a banner near 29th and Allegheny, Ron Ross says he's heard people call the area all kinds of things, East Falls, Allegheny West, or simply Allegheny, but never Swamp Poodle.
I don't know what to say about it. You know what I mean? I guess it's going to take some getting used to. I don't know how many people would actually call this area Swamp Poodle, but, you know, it's up there, so I guess some folks will.
The confusion and hesitation is understandable. Swamp Poodle hasn't been used for generations and largely faded from memory. This was the area where the old Connie Mack Stadium once stood, where Italian and then Irish immigrants lived before it became a predominantly African-American neighborhood. Denise Whitaker isn't kidding herself. She knows that banners on utility poles won't change things overnight, or maybe at all. She still sees sense in trying and staying optimistic.
We're just hanging in until something happens. There's a thing, you know, push. Push until something happens. P-U-S-H. So that's what we're doing.
In Zip 19132, I'm Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
Every Zip Philadelphia is a collaboration between WHYY and Finding America, a national initiative produced by AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, with financial support from the Wincote Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov and Kimberly Haas, with help today from Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.